And we will begin then with the forging of Finnish American communism with Alvo Kostiainen and presenting the Sosialisti. Teollisuustyöläinen. I messed that one up, didn't I? I can't pronounce the really long Finnish words. But industrialisti, which I am very well acquainted with since my father was a working member of it for many years. Alvo.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that Arlene has a very good pronunciation in Finnish. I have heard so many forms and variations of my first and last name that I can't even count them, but she is perhaps the best here in the States.
Thank you.
Actually, I have to change my title, because if I were talking about the forging of Finnish-American communism, I would talk about different things, what I am going now to say. And that's why my new title, just formulated, is Radical Socialism, Syndicalism and Communism, or Socialisti, Industrialisti in the 1910s. The Supreme Court of Minnesota reached on December 2, 1921, the decision of the case State versus Workers' Socialist Publishing Company et al. The court decided that the newspaper Industrialisti, I pronounce now it in Finnish way all the time, published by the said company as well as its managing editor, had violated the laws of criminal syndicalism. The previous ruling from the St. Louis County District Court had also convicted the business manager Toivonen, but the Supreme Court reversed that part of the decision. This decision ended an era of the Finnish language radical press in Minnesota. At that time, in the beginning of the 1920s, the court cases or red raids were already slowing down, although they didn't stop at all, totally. In the following, an analysis will be presented on the development of Socialisti Industrialisti newspaper, a radical dissenting voice of the Finnish-American workers in Minnesota. The task is to study its founding and development into an IWW supporter. How and why did this happen, and who were the leaders in this process? The newspapers and periodicals served the Finnish-American community in many ways, but they also made a forum for ideological warfare against the bad sides of American capitalist society. Especially the problems were low wages, long working days, poor working conditions. Although the Finns were latecomers in America by the early 1910s, the Finnish immigrant group in Minnesota had grown to several tens of thousands. There were more than 26,000 Finns born in Finland, and the Finns were the largest foreign-born group, especially in the St. Louis County. The Finns had organized temperance groups, churches, workmen's societies, established many newspapers, periodicals of varying ideological orientations. Among the most visible papers were those of the labor movement. The question of tactics was at an early stage discussed among the Finnish-American labor movement. At first, ideological and organizational models were taken from Europe, social democracy and the old country. But soon the role of the industrial workers of the world formed in 1905 as a kind of protest against the ineffectiveness of the American Federation of Labor rose into the debates. The increasing radical opinions were formed mostly on the basis of the experiences received from the 1907 Mesabi iron ore miners strike led by the Western Federation of Miners, a radical trade union at that time, with strong Finnish and other ethnic participation. The consequences of this strike were important. In this struggle, workers learned of the conflict with the employers and the unwillingness of the society to protect strikers. Many strikers were forced to move to farms because of blacklistings. Also, tension inside the Finnish community was intensified. The so-called Church Finns tried to establish the reputation of Finns as good workers through the statements they gave in publicity, or as the bitter socialists called them, the Judas resolutions. The conventions of the central organization of Finnish American labor movement, the Finnish Socialist Federation, reflected the ideological disputes of the American socialist movement. The moderates accepted the gradual political reforms, while the radicals urged social and political revolution, overthrow of capitalism and organization by industries. The Duluth Work People's College Työväenopisto was a center for ideological debate as well as an opinion leader. In Duluth, the IWW ideology was studied and leadership educated. In the process, a few personalities became notable. The first was Leo Laukki, who directed the college for several years from 1907. He was also the editor of Työmies newspaper, at that time published in Hancock, Michigan. Another person was Yrjö Sirola, an important leftist politician from Finland, who was teaching in the college from 1910 to 1913. These two promoted radical leftist ideas. Laukki even favored the idea of sabotage. Both of them moved later to Soviet Russia. Also, John Vita was a teacher in the college, editor of Socialisti, and later an important figure in the American communist movement under the name Henri Puro. Also, another person, Santeri Nuorteva, was teaching at the college in the early 1910s. Later, even he became a leading person in the Soviet Russian Information Bureau in the United States, and eventually moved to Russia and became the president of Soviet Karelia. All of those persons and others, they were active teachers, writers, and ideologists. In 1912, the Finnish Federation Convention met in the college rooms located in Smithville, a suburb of Duluth. A clearly radical line was accepted, even though Laukki had to reverse his speeches on the acceptance of sabotage. After an intense debate, a resolution was accepted which pointed up the necessity of industrial unionism. It was not the same as the acceptance of the IWW, since warning was issued against anti-socialist movements. Sabotage and anarcho-syndicalistic anti-parliamentarism, as is what said. After the Smithville Convention in 1912, the popularity of IWW in Minnesota increased. This was reflected in the founding of the newspaper Socialisti, or Socialist. However, the split in the Finnish Federation developed largely following the Copper Country strike of Upper Michigan, 1913-1940. The employers used strikebreakers, armed guards, vigilante groups, and so on. Attention was gained especially through the so-called Italian Hall disaster, where 73 adults and children, many of them Finns, died while having a Christmas party. The strikers accused the company officials for purposely causing the panic. At that time, the Finnish Socialist Federation published Työmies, or Working Man, in Hancock. In the spring of 1914, the radicals of the Central District, or in Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, tried to size this newspaper, but the Eastern United States moderate Finnish American socialists came to help and purchased the shares of Työmies and started financially to support it. So this was the marking point of the founding of this Socialisti, which later came Industrialisti. The radicals selected as the natural base for their newspaper the town of Duluth. And it was Socialisti, as its successors, was printed in a local conservative or commercial publishing house. It was printed there. Of course, the publisher was always the Finnish publisher. There has been discussion about the relation of Socialisti to IWW. It has been said that the paper immediately adopted the IWW line, but it seems more reasonable to think that it only gradually came to support the IWW. In Socialisti, we find many notices which give support also to the traditional political activities. Thus, launching its program for the new year of 1916, the paper announced support both for political activities and for more radical actions through, for example, the IWW. The editors announced that they accepted political parties and political actions in principle and conditionally even approved the Socialist Party of America. However, they cautioned that the Socialist Party should take a radical line, fight the real class struggle, and really work for the working class. This is how the debate was going on. And the Finnish Federation leaders and these radicals of Central District came into conflict. The Federation banned the Socialisti, and economic support to it was cut off. This led to the disruption of the Finnish Federation. It had about 12,500 members in the whole of country and about 3,000 members from the Central District, from Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, were expelled. Between 1914 and 1916, more than 50 radical socialist branches departed or were expelled from the Finnish Federation because of these ideological quarrels. But also we have to remember that especially in Minnesota, there was a considerable number of loyal supporters of the Finnish Federation, which supported the newspaper Työmies, which had been moved to Superior, Wisconsin, just a few miles from the city of Duluth in the fall of 1914. Työmies had adopted the line of radical socialism, and in the following years, and especially after the Russian Revolution, this paper became an open supporter of the communist movement in America. During the years 1914-1916, an animated discussion went on the pages of Socialisti in regard to the possibilities and means of affecting the American society and politics. Among the editors and readers of the paper, the more direct and radical methods of the IWW received increasing support. The inability of other parties or conservative trade unions to cope with the challenges of increasing pressures was seen as an important factor. The newer immigrants had naturally difficulties in adopting themselves into English-speaking or American political system and political society. When the IWW was interested in these newcomers and presented strong ideas and usable tactics, many immigrant workers were apt to follow IWW. Especially the IWW gained fame in the Mesabi Range through the strike of summer 1916. The strikers' headquarters was located in Virginia, Finn Hall. And the Finns, Serbians, Montenegros, Italians, and others struggled against the companies in vain. We can follow from the pages of Socialisti the going of the strike, because the newspaper told about the strike daily, and we can see the notices on the beginning of the strike, early June 1916, and then we can see how it became larger and larger. New groups were coming along in the strike, and finally, in late June 1916, the headlines of the paper told that the strike was total. All the Mesabi Range was on strike. And now the news and comments of the paper told about the violence of the strike, about the arrests of the agitators about mass meetings of the workers, and it was told how massive flow of new members came into the ranks of the IWW. But the strike went on and on. Gradually, optimism withered away. Towards the fall, the headlines became shorter, and in September 1916, the strike was finally over. But still, the strike had a meaning for the future. It strengthened the image of the IWW as the union which was on the workers' side. And even if the strike was lost, the IWW showed that it had made a big effort for them. The strike was also meaningful in the development of socialism towards acceptance of industrial unionism. Electoral activity had again shown its uselessness, it seemed. Therefore, the support for the IWW among the immigrant Finns grew notably. The tendency was strengthened also by the successful strikes the IWW organized in the western parts of the country. To mark the changing political philosophy, the editors changed the name of Socialisti. On December 20th, 1916, the first issue of Teollisuustyöläinen, or in English, the Industrial Worker, appeared. It was the manifestation of the move towards close collaboration with the IWW. The publisher continued to be the Socialist Publishing Company. The editor in chief was the famous syndicalist leader Leo Laukki. Co-editors included notables like a very anarchistic person called William Risto. Still, new faces were seen. On March 19, 1917, Teollisuustyöläinen, Industrial Worker, changed the title again. Now it became Industrialisti, or the Industrialist. It is said that this was due to the legal problems of the paper with a minister of the Finnish Unitarian Church. But from now on, there was no doubt about the connection between Industrialisti and the IWW. The paper announced open support of industrial unionism and advocated for organization by industries. In 1917, Industrialisti with other IWW organs especially became known for their opposition to the United States participation in the war. For example, the first issue of Industrialisti in March 1917 clearly presented anti-war opinions on the front page. The paper compared the attitudes of the AFL and the IWW towards the war. The AFL was seen as a nationalistic supporter of war. The IWW was praised for its international stand in the war question. Because of the anti-war attitudes and the organization of strikes, the IWW now became a target for repression. In September 1917, the government launched a special operation against IWW headquarters in Chicago, its local offices and supporters around the country. The office of Industrialisti in Duluth was also raided twice at this time. Public attitude in the United States thus became hostile to immigrants and to radicals especially. Nationalistic spirit was particularly strong after the entry into the war, and in 1920, the persecution of radicals and aliens culminated into the so-called Red Raids under Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. Industrialist's office in Duluth was raided again in January 1920. Three editors were arrested and a legal showdown took place in the St. Louis County Court. And as told in the beginning, the case went to the Supreme Court of Minnesota. A number of Finns and Scandinavian immigrants were arrested in Minnesota, mainly in Twin Cities and in northern Minnesota. The radical Finnish Americans were included in the so-called Red Raids, but the cases and court sentences in particular were still relatively few if we consider the active participation of the Finns in radical activities in North America. In this respect, the most known cases, the above mentioned Chicago 166 in 1918 with five Finnish IWW leaders. The person mentioned earlier, Leo Laukki, got a sentence of 20 years for espionage and conspiracy. But after a couple of years, he went to Soviet Russia and got out of the jail through bails. Many Finns found a way to escape to the northern woods, and perhaps even hundreds went to the remote mining and lumbering towns of Canada. Many Finns were simply ignorant of the military obligations and of the possibility that they could be drafted into the army. Others, of course, were too aware of the draft, and many radicals escaped before being drafted. Perhaps hundreds of Finnish Americans were arrested because they didn't register properly for the draft. Thus, in July, August 1917, more than 100 Finns were tried in the St. Louis County District Court in Duluth. Of these 106 were sentenced, 12 of them went to jail for about half a year, 1 year, 2 years. In general, Finnish American radicals abided still the law, as their leaders urged. They had many legal activities, social activities, lots of property. There have been earlier already talk about the so-called Finn halls. They had newspapers, cooperative stores were growing in Minnesota, and so on. Thus, they saw that their losses could be very great if they were especially harassed by the authorities. The Finns could see that other ethnic groups, like the Germans, Russians, South Slavs, and some others, were under suspicion. On the other hand, when considered on a nationwide scale, the Finns rarely had positions of leadership, which would draw attention to them. This fact tended somewhat to reduce the Finnish radical profile. In the early 1920s, then, two radical groups had especially strong support among the Minnesota Finns. On the one hand, there were the Finnish communists, who became an important part of the legal Communist Party, the Workers' Party of America, founded in December 1921. The Finns formed about half of this party's membership in its early years. In Minnesota, the Communist Finnish Federation had more than 20 active branches and more than 600 registered members in the early 1920s. And after some years, this number was growing very fast. And also the communists were taking control increasingly in the cooperatives. On the other hand, the Wobblies, or IWW supporters, with the industrialisti, remained the strongest or largest radical Finnish group for still some years. Even though several of their leaders and rank-and-file members turned to communism, and even the famous IWW leader, like Big Bill Haywood, had turned to communism and went to Soviet Russia. And these kind of turnovers, of course, were a big blow for the future of the IWW. However, the Finnish IWW still had the ability to function for decades. For example, the newspaper Industrialisti functioned until, I think, 1976. The IWW had strong centers of support for many years among the Finns, and the Finnish IWW halls also were an important place for social and cultural activities. The circulation of Industrialisti in the beginning of 1920s reached more than 10,000, which was a large number for an immigrant paper. Its center of support was in Minnesota, and it may even be estimated that in the early years of 1920s, there were in Minnesota more than 3,000 active industrialist subscribers. In conclusion, the task of the Finnish radical press in Minnesota was not an easy one in the 1910s. Ideologically, the radicals in America faced two splits of the socialist movement. The first was caused by the growing influence of the IWW, and the second by the Russian Bolshevik Revolution. The war effort intensified government control and limited the possibilities of the press to deliver communication to the immigrant workers. And of course, there was the Minnesota Public Safety Commission, which I don't have time to talk here about, even if it also was interested somehow in the Finns. The Finnish-American radical press strongly reflected both events from mentioned above, both from international and American levels. The pressure from the host society was very strong. The newspapers had to tread a narrow line to avoid legal persecution while still successfully serving their readership. However, they seemed to do this quite well, for even in the hostile atmosphere, industrialisti managed in the early 1920s to increase its circulation. Later in the 1920s, while the IWW itself was losing support, the newspaper industrialisti still fulfilled a great deal of the need for a Finnish language labor paper in the Midwest and also in Canada. Thank you.
Thank you. Dick?
Between the uncompromising denunciation of Wilson's war by the St. Louis Convention and the American Socialist Party in April 1917 and the passage of the Espionage Act 2 months later, was not an auspicious time to launch a socialist weekly. Nevertheless, the first number of the Labor Leader, the official organ of the Socialist Party of Duluth, appeared on May Day, 1917. Representing the Scandinavian, Finnish, Jewish, and English locals of Duluth, the Labor Leader stood firmly behind the anti-war position of the St. Louis Convention. Its editor, W.E. Reynolds, bid good riddance to the pro-war socialists with, quote, "No tears, no flowers, and congratulations to the party," end quote. Basing itself on the scientific socialism of Marx and Engels, the Labor Leader traced the roots of the war to the dynamics of capitalism and offered its readers a series of didactic articles on the fundamentals of Marxist economics. But though priding itself on the depth of its scientific theory, the Labor Leader was by no means an academic observer on the world around it. The paper denounced the war, conscription, war profiteers, and the fig leaf patriotism by which respectable capitalists hid the repression they directed. The Labor Leader stood with those, quote, "real socialists," unquote, who were not out for municipal ice cream foundries and the like, but, quote, "for the world and all it contains for the workers," end quote. And in direct violation of the National Convention of the Socialist Party at Indianapolis in 1912, the Labor Leader defended direct action as but an extension of the methods of the Boston Tea Party to the cause of the emancipation of labor. Under the influence of Reynolds' wife, Laura, the Labor Leader, and later Truth, showed a sensitivity to women's issues. Support for the suffrage movement appeared repeatedly from the very first number on. In addition, the paper carried stories on Japanese feminism, demonstrations by women in Germany and Argentina, and on the need for birth control and sex education. Laura Reynolds also wrote Kitty Corner, a regular column for children, seconded her husband's call for worker education, and appeared as the featured speaker at a meeting of the English language local, wrote on the ideology of frugality, and served as the corresponding secretary for the Duluth branch of the People's Council for Peace and Democracy. Soon also endorsed as the official organ of the Superior Wisconsin Socialists, Superior's just across the bridge, the Labor Leader and the Reynolds played a significant role in the Twin Ports socialist movement. From an initial press run of 5,000 for the May Day number, circulation increased to 20,000 by August 9th, with 1,000 paid subscribers by August 31st. The paper regularly printed accounts of the dances, entertainments, programs, fundraisers, and comrade meetings of the various locals, and in turn, the locals supported the paper with fundraisers, subscription drives, and written contributions from local activists. Early in October of 1917, in keeping with the suppression of virtually all socialist press in the United States, the United States Post Office ruled that the labor leader was in violation of the Espionage Act and denied the paper second-class mail privileges. Without missing a week, the paper reappeared on August 12th under the new name of Truth. It's a weekly paper. Still under the editorship of Reynolds, the paper was published by the Duluth Cooperative Society, a collection of local socialists who put up money to keep the paper afloat. Without second-class mail privileges and in the face of hostile local forces, the paper persevered. By the end of 1917, Truth had clearly established itself on the left wing of the Socialist Party. Besides its uncompromising stand against the war, Truth openly supported the IWW. It denounced craft unionism as outmoded and called for the formation of industrial unions. And in the context of the split in the international socialist movement into reformist and revolutionary wings, Truth stood for revolution. For reasons that are not entirely clear, the executive committee of the local publishing cooperative decided to replace Reynolds as editor with a charismatic Irish journalist, Jack Carney. Carney was ably assisted by his wife, Mina, and I will not be able to do justice to her role in the paper because of the time constraints. Under their guidance, Truth maintained its stand for revolutionary industrial unionism and its defense of the IWW. But it took an increasingly internationalist perspective. In his very first editorial statement for Truth, Carney identified the goal as international working class control. Though Truth continued to comment on local issues to support birth control and to demand equal pay for women, the world-shaking events of 1918 and 1919 increasingly dominated its pages. On page 1 for November 9, 1917, recognizing its possible historic importance, Truth reprinted text from a manifesto issued by the Military Revolutionary Committee in Russia. In the months that followed, Truth followed the course of the Bolshevik Revolution, the Civil War and foreign interventions, and the beginnings of the construction of socialism in Russia. In bold headlines, Truth demanded hands off Russia. It exulted in the triumph of Soviet Russia over seemingly insurmountable opposition and terrible suffering. It raised funds for famine relief in Russia. It recruited skilled workers to go to the Kuzbass region and help in the building of socialism. And it tried to understand the Russian revolutionary experience in order to apply that experience to the cause of the emancipation of the working class all over the world. Like many other left-wing socialists, and High Berman alluded to this, Carney saw in the Bolshevik Revolution a confirmation of his own conception of revolutionary industrial unionism. Carney was convinced that the ruling class would refuse to honor any electoral result which genuinely threatened capitalism. He saw in the refusal of the New York legislature to seat elected socialists, in the indictment of most of the leadership of the Socialist Party, and in the suppression of socialist newspapers, American confirmation of this view. Militant industrial unions, armed with a weapon of strike action, provided a means whereby the working class could enforce the democratic will against the hostile ruling class. Further, industrial unions provided the foundation for democratic self-management of industry in the socialist society of the future. This vision of democratic revolutionary industrial unionism grew out of Carney's own experience with the Irish Transport Workers Union and out of the syndicalist theories that were popular with left socialists all over the Western Europe in the years just prior to the war. Carney saw in both the IWW and in the Russian Soviets model revolutionary unions. By January of 1919, Carney had become convinced of the need for a change in the national leadership of the American Socialist Party. The left-wing manifesto prepared by nationally prominent leaders of the Socialist Party left, appeared in Truth in February. Consistent with Carney's aim of uniting all industrial unionists, the manifesto sought to capture rather than split the Socialist Party. It was only because of the right-wing refusal to abide by the results of the internal SP elections, its expulsion of the left, and barring of the left from the SP August Convention in Chicago, that Carney was forced to organize outside the Socialist Party, leading Truth and the strong Duluth Scandinavian local into the emerging American communist movement. The Scandinavian local was the rock upon which Truth was built. With 400 plus members throughout the years of the paper's existence, the Scandinavian local provided the leadership for the publishing collective behind Truth, which was an English language paper, and also provided crucial financial support for the paper. The local also appears to have held a fairly coherent political orientation toward industrial unionism and revolutionary, as opposed to reformist, socialism. Carney tells us that many members of the local were also members of the IWW, and it is surely no coincidence that each of the editors of Truth, Reynolds, Carney, Bentel, and Van Hove, stood for revolutionary industrial unionism. The Scandinavian local appears to have been one of the strongest Socialist Party locals in the state of Minnesota. Victor Nordin, a central figure, was a laborer at one of the grain elevators. O.E. Thompson was in real estate. Carl Nordmark, who did paintings for fundraisers, was also in real estate. Martin Haglund was an electrician. Arvid Layden was a carpenter. Nels Benson was a driver. And Hilmer Johnson was a baker. John Essen was a meter man. Each of these names appears in Truth because each man took a leadership role. Many of the rank and file had good reason not to want their names to appear in the paper. Residents of Riverside and of Morgan Park, the steel company model town within Duluth, were afraid to have Truth delivered to their homes. Identified by a company spy, steel worker Ivor Feld was fired for attending a meeting at Workers' Hall. Duluth radicals also had problems with the Minnesota Public Safety Commission, the local commercial club, and the thugs they set in motion. Advertisers in Truth were threatened. Thugs tried to force a socialist barber in Superior to buy Liberty bonds. He refused. A socialist meeting was disrupted. Another was prevented and the speaker arrested by the authorities. Soldiers raided the IWW office and bullied the secretary there. The suspicious hanging of a Finnish IWW member who had been tarred and feathered was ruled a suicide. The Northwest Warriors Committee on Americanization published a notice in the Duluth News Tribune, the major newspaper, declaring its intent to run Carney out of the United States. And finally, in a few years, mere membership in a communist organization was ruled by a U.S. court sufficient grounds for deportation. Together with the dehumanized view of foreigners shared by many Americans, quotation marks around that, this repressive atmosphere makes it understandable that some local Scandinavian, Finnish, and Jewish radicals preferred to keep a low profile. In a 1974 interview with Michael Brook, Mina Carney recalled that the membership of the local was overwhelmingly Swedish and that many of the members worked in the building trades and in lumber yards. Swedish as opposed to Norwegian, okay? But at this point, I do not have a clear picture of the membership of the Scandinavian local. What is clear is that they like to dance. With the exception of a period when the official flu ban precluded public meetings, every week the Scandinavian local held, in addition to the comrades meeting, at least one lecture and one entertainment. In the week following the flu ban, apparently feeling deprived, the local held four dances in addition to one entertainment and a comrades meeting. The Scandinavian sewing circle regularly put on dances, fundraisers, parties, and entertainments. Scandinavian women also appear as subscription promoters and financial contributors. One of them, Sabina Rodberg, appears as a member of the publishing collective. Another, who may be a Scandinavian woman, but the name appears not to be Scandinavian, Bertha Van Hove, served as both a public speaker and as an editor of Truth after Bentall was returned to prison. Staying out of prison was a problem for the editors of Truth. 4 months after taking over as editor, Carney was charged with sedition under the Espionage Act. This was for printing the anti-war U.S. Senate campaign platform of Victor Berger. In November of 1919, the U.S. Department of Justice began deportation proceedings against Carney. In December, less than 2 weeks later, a federal charge was brought against Carney. The complaint held that in publishing Hands Off Russia, protesting Allied intervention against the Bolsheviks, Carney was guilty of obstructing enlistments into the armed forces. The next month, January of 1920, brought charges under the Illinois Sedition Law against Carney and others who had played a part in the formation of the Communist Labor Party in Chicago the previous August. Yet another charge under the Illinois Sedition Law was made against Carney 2 months later in March of 1920. This means that by the time Carney left Duluth to work for the Butte Daily Bulletin in October of 1920, he was simultaneously fighting serious charges in Duluth and Chicago and fighting deportation proceedings as well. 1 week after his arrival in Butte, Carney was arrested yet again. When Carney left to work with the Butte Daily Bulletin, the editorship of Truth was taken over by J.O. Bentall. Bentall, though he had been the 1916 Socialist Party candidate for governor of Minnesota, had clearly taken a position in support of the IWW. He had also already served a year in prison for Espionage Act charges of obstructing the draft. Two themes, support for the IWW and defense of civil liberties, were central to Truth during the period of Bentall's editorship. Nearly every issue touched on both. But Bentall also stoutly defended the Bolshevik Revolution and drew from the Russian experience the necessity of a dictatorship of the proletariat, at least for the period of the transition from capitalism to socialism. Like Carney, Bentall understood this dictatorship as the political arm whereby the revolutionary working class defended itself against the forces of reaction, and also as an instrument for coordinating the construction of socialism, and as based on the principle that only those who work can vote. One of the interesting features of Bentall's communism is its Christianity. Though highly critical of institutionalized religions, Bentall went so far as to say that, quote, all good communists are deeply religious, end quote. In this respect, Bentall's communism differed from the communism of Carney. Another difference surfaces in Bentall's support of the Nonpartisan League and the Farmer Labor Party, and in general in his willingness to consider the farmer as an ally in the fight against plutocracy. Barnyard Observations by Bolshevik, the title of some of Bentall's early columns, gives a sense of his vision and his roots. But if less cosmopolitan than Carney, Bentall was nonetheless possessed of a humane and revolutionary spirit. In spite of occasional sexist jokes, Bentall not only rejected the view, born of the economic downturn following the war, that women should quit work, he went on to argue that the real liberation of women required their financial independence, and hence that housework should be paid. He says of the shop girl who turned down a chance to be the queen at the auto show that she must be a Bolshevik. And he defends working class girls against charges that they lack refinement. On the issue of racism, Truth was less large-minded. Though officially opposed to racism, problems of black workers and black people received virtually no attention, and this in spite of significant radicalism among black workers in the post-war period. Deeply racist attitudes appear at a few points in the history of the paper under Bentall, Carney, and Reynolds. Greater sensitivity to racism is displayed by the editor who assumed responsibility for Truth with Bentall's return to prison in January of 1922 on another charge of obstructing the draft. It is not clear who this new editor was. On January 13th, 1922, a statement appears to the effect that the board of directors have secured an editor to replace Bentall, but the editor is not identified. It is not until 8 months later when, in a statement required by its restored second-class mail privileges, the editor is identified as B. Van Hove. Miss Bertha Van Hove had earlier been listed in Truth as a speaker at local meetings, one dealing with the topic, Women Who Want the Revolution. Whether Van Hove had indeed served as editor during the previous months and hidden her identity, perhaps out of concern that a woman would not be taken seriously, or whether someone else edited Truth in the time in question, I cannot at this point say. In any case, the very first number of Truth published by the unknown editor contained a poem, I Am a Negro Woman, by Dady Randall, that is the most sensitive and empathetic treatment of racism to appear in Truth. Continuing Truth's commitment to communism and revolutionary industrial unionism, the new editor also included a number of sensitive pieces on imperialism, equal pay for women, working class kids, unemployment suicides, problems of working class parents, family relations, the double binds women face, medical care, and the seductions of modern commercialized art. In addition, Truth maintained a high standard of coverage of international and national affairs and continued to print articles of theoretical importance. Some difficulties were evident. The editorial page often reprinted earlier editorials by Bentall. There were several complaints about the stupidity and apathy of workers. There is a hint of nostalgia for the comrades' meetings of pre-war times. And there's some bewilderment about why a labor party is necessary as well as the workers' party. In addition, in December of 1922, there is mention of discussion within the workers' party of starting an English language daily and discontinuing the two weeklies if necessary. Whether this discussion is connected with the demise of Truth, I cannot say, but in spite of repeated claims to an improving financial picture, the April 13th number of Truth announced itself as the last, blaming lack of funds caused by the apathy of the workers. Truth was a quality production. It had the look of state-of-the-art technology. It brought its readers the thoughts of nearly all the major figures on the American left. And especially under Carney, it brought the writings of most of the leading European figures as well. Throughout the nearly 6 years of its existence, Truth consistently stood for revolutionary industrial unionism. That a newspaper of such uncompromising politics should appear, that it should defend itself with such sophistication, and that it should have the strong support of local workers is hard to comprehend from our current vantage point. How am I doing on time? Fantastic. Well, I was racing to try to squeeze in a few remarks, and I've got more time than I need, so we'll contribute a little bit extra here. Just a few quick comments, okay? There are obvious connections with some of the things that John Haynes mentioned earlier. The theme of trashing the workers for their stupidity and apathy and backwardness and so forth appears, especially in the later years of Truth's existence. It struck me while John was talking that there is blame the workers are stupid, that was one possibility. The other possibility was that New Times was out of touch with American workers and the fault lies with the paper. There is, in a sense, a false contrast here. It might be that the workers were stupid and that New Times was out of touch with the stupid workers. Okay? That maybe misses the important point in what was going on here. There is a piece that appears late in Truth by John Lewis, an English radical whom I've never heard of. Maybe Michael Brooks can say something about him. And he suggests that what's happening in England and Germany and in Western Europe and in the United States is that management is becoming more sophisticated. They're seizing control of the production process in ways that they did not have before the war. And that the result is the creation of more stupid workers, the control of capitalism is more firmly entrenched. John alluded to that as a possible answer. Another point I'd like to comment on. It would be nice to think that there's a sort of smooth transition from the revolutionary spirit of 1919 to the farmer labor movement of the mid-20s. From the point of view of truth, this is not the case. Truth resisted the farmer labor movement. Bentall was supportive, but among the four editors, he was the only one who was supportive. The others opposed it on the grounds that the farmer labor movement was not socialism. And this is also a point that connects with some of the remarks that John made. Truth denounced the Van Leer socialists on the grounds that this wasn't really socialism. They may have won the election in Minneapolis, but they haven't won socialism. What we need is socialism. Okay. Truth was under no illusions about the coming of a revolution in the United States. Even at the headiest period, during, say, spring of 1919, Truth did not think that the United States was on the verge of revolution. It did think that Germany, Hungary, Italy, and possibly England were on the verge of revolution. And it saw its role as a part of an international struggle, sort of like soldiers who are assigned to a portion of the front where no advance is likely, but where they stand in solidarity with those who are advancing elsewhere. Kearney warned repeatedly about the need to stay in touch with U.S. workers while at the same time raising the issue of socialism and not watering the politics down. Of course, this is easier said than done. Finally, I'd like to respond to the earlier comment about whether socialism is still on the agenda or not. My own view is that it certainly is, that we make a mistake if we confuse liberal democratic politics with socialist politics, and that collective ownership of the means of production is at least a necessary condition for the emancipation of the working class and all of us.